Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 165, which is the second part of our look at the evolution of ants with Dr. Christine Sosiak of the Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology. As with every two-part episode, we are legally required to remind you to go and listen to part one first, otherwise you're missing out on a huge amount of context about what ants are and how they live. In this second part, we're going to be looking at their fossil record, when they evolved and how they fared through the end Cretaceous mass extinction. I'd like to give a shout out to r/ants on Reddit, who were a super welcoming community. If you are here for the arthropods, I'd just like to point your attention to our catalogue of episodes, in which we speak about them a fair bit. In fact, our next episode will be about the origins of teeth in vertebrates, but this incredible story unexpectedly features a huge amount of arthropod exoskeletons, so it's definitely not one to be missed by anyone. But if you can't wait for our next episode, then there are a huge amount of other paleo podcasts out there for you to try. We have them listed on our website with all the relevant links, and we also like to use our platform to help new shows find their audience with this, our Paleo Podcast plug. I think this latest show is probably the one with the most authoritative hosts, so please check them out because you'll be tapping into an absolute wealth of paleontological knowledge.
Hi Paleocast fans, I'm Rob.
And I'm Susie.
We are the presenters of a new podcast called The Fossil Files.
In our podcast, we take a scientific paper recently published every week, and we read it, basically.
We want to bring to you the latest discoveries and go through them and bring the world of scientific advances to you. What sort of topics have we covered recently, Susie?
Well, we have talked about fossilised poo. We've talked about footprints, although that one's coming out next, so look out for that one. We've talked about... Oh, what else have we talked about? Dinosaurs, Neanderthals, plesiosaurs, all sorts of things.
Yeah, more to come. So look forward out for us. We are available on Apple and Spotify, and we really thank the PaleoCast team for letting us talk to you. We like the work that PaleoCast does. They do sorts of interesting stuff. If you like the sorts of things that PaleoCast do, give us a listen. We're available on Apple and Spotify, and you can always get us in contact with your thoughts on our website at fossils.libsyn.com. Thanks.
And so, back to ants. We're going to be tracking their evolution through time, as well as looking at some of the extinct hell ants, which just really need to be seen to be believed. We've therefore got evolutionary trees, photos, illustrations, reconstructions on our website that will all help you follow the discussion, so please do take a look at that. And if you like this episode, any kind of engagement online will help the show grow, and so will always be appreciated. And since we only really share new content, subscribing or following is fairly safe to do. So I'll speak to you all again in a couple of weeks, and in the meantime, I hope you enjoy this episode. Right, so evolution then. We could just do a whole podcast on modern ants, but let's get into the point of it being paleo. So are they a monophyletic group? And what I mean by that is I'm just looking out my window at a tree. If I take a pair of clippers and just cut off one branch, there we go, that is ants. Everything from that branch all the way to the end, all ants? Or are they, say, like paraphyletic or polyphyletic, like I cut my branch off, but then maybe not this leaf or little twig here, let's get rid of that, that's not an ant. Or if I've got two branches and I'm like, okay, these together are ants, that'd be like polyphyletic. Is it just one, cut that branch off, here is my branch of ants on the tree?
That is such a great explanation of monophily and polyphily and periphily. I love it.
It's not. It's terrible. I just made it up. But if it made sense, I'm glad.
It makes a lot of sense, especially for someone who's not, you know, familiar with the lingo. Yes, ants are monophyletic. So they have the common ancestor of all ants, and all 14,000 species are included in that.
Mm-hmm. And then if we look a little bit further up the tree, are there other ant-like ancestors that aren't as anty as ants? What's the bit of the tree where ants evolve that define what an ant is? Do they get like a certain anatomical part that makes them ants and defines them from their ancestors?
Yes, absolutely. So it's sort of a combination of traits when it comes to looking at ants. So when we look at wasps that are closely related to ants, especially with mm-hmm. wasps where the females have secondarily lost their wings, you can see some wasps that look really, really similar to ants. And so the ancestor of ants that was kind of in between ants and wasps, that would have looked a lot like these ant-y wasps that we see today. But there are several distinguishing factors specifically for ants. And one of those is when you look at ant antennae, they have kind of like a little elbow in them. Okay. And so it looks sort of like little elbowed antennae. They also have a certain segment right in between their thorax and their gaster. That's the petiolar segment. So that's distinguishing of ants. And another distinguishing factor of ants is what's called the metapleural gland. So the metapleural gland it's in the thorax of the ants, and it produces certain compounds that are related to sociality in ants. So these compounds are, they can be fungicidal, so they are producing things that basically help look after the babies. And then the last thing that you tend to see, one of the last things that defines ants as a group is a reduction of the thorax itself. So if you look at wasps, if you look at bees, they have quite a large thorax. And that's because the thorax is containing a lot of the muscles, the flight muscles, that are necessary for them to power flight. In workers, they don't have to power flight anymore. And so there is a reduction in the number of sclerates. So that's the number of like plates in the cuticle. So there's a reduction in that, and their thoraxes basically kind of get smaller.
Okay. So you got the head, the thorax is the middle bit, and then the abdomen is like the butt.
Yeah, the butt.
Is that right? Yeah. So it's like a reduced middle bit.
A reduced middle bit, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that is related to losing the flight muscles and having this caste that doesn't need flight muscles. They're not going out to mate with others. They are workers in the colony, so they don't need those flight muscles anymore.
And so we've got what defines the ants, those characteristics that I've just completely forgotten. So then do we have like an ant lineage that doesn't have a couple of those, that they would, you know, like appear to be ants for all intents and purposes, just missing one or two of that characters that excludes them from the ant branch of the tree?
Yes, exactly. So we have what are called the stem ants. So these are ants that they are still ants. They're more closely related to modern ants than anything else is, but they don't have modern descendants of their own. So you can kind of think mm-hmm. of it a little bit like birds and theropod dinosaurs. They are very closely related, but they don't have any descendants of their own. And these stem ants, they have all of the traits that I was just talking about, these traits of ants. But one of the really distinguishing feature of stem ants is that they still have a little bit more of a larger thorax. They have more of these sclerites in there. So they're in the process of reducing that thorax to that specialized worker caste, but they're not all the way there yet.
And so is, like with the dinosaur and birds, is there like an archaeopteryx You know, like, is there a holy grail of ant evolution where there's just like this one remarkable fossil find? Because it must be so hard to find fossils of these stem ants.
They are not easy to find, that's for sure. We do have some fossils of ants that kind of look a little bit like a mosaic between ants and wasps. So we have these things that sort of look like they might be Archaeopteryx, but it's so very, very difficult to figure out, like, okay, is this, you know, the ant wasp? Is this the one that we're looking for? And we might never even find that, but we do have what I would say is like a pretty decent sort of gradient along that ant to, along that wasp to ant.
So when do the ants and some of the stem ants first appear in the fossil record? You said that termites went back to the Jurassic.
Yes. Is it
Cretaceous, did you say?
The ants are Cretaceous. And it's funny because, you know, if we had recorded this podcast like a month earlier, I would have told you that the oldest ant fossils that we have are 100 million years old. So kind of like smack in the middle of the Cretaceous. But they just found a new fossil ant species from Brazil, the Crato Formation, which is very exciting and pushes the fossil record of ants back 13 million more years and completely changes everything that we know about, or completely changes everything that we hypothesize about the biogeography of the earliest ants. So now I can tell you that the oldest ant fossil is 113 million years old.
That's timely then.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So if ants evolved from stem ants, and now the oldest ant is an ant, that means that the split between the stem ants and the ants must have occurred even earlier.
Yes. Well, stem ants didn't, you know, modern ants didn't evolve from stem ants. They shared a common ancestor.
Oh,
but
right.
Yes. The common ancestor of stem ants and crown ants, modern ants, is probably somewhere between 140 to 160 million years old. We don't know.
Okay.
But based off of, molecular estimates and phylogenetic reconstructions, somewhere in there.
Yeah. It's incredible. Like, if you don't know about phylogenetics and stuff, you can, like, look at divergence rates and rates of mutation and then see how long it would estimate, like, when they would have to have split. So you can think of, like, based on all the evidence that we have now and how quickly things evolve, their ancestor must have lived probably around this time. So it's incredible that you can do that with phylogenetics. So if we have ants and stem ants, they must have evolved, they must have been living at the same time. Did they get on? Were they doing different things? How did that work?
Oh, it's a great question, actually, because it's definitely still a really open question for understanding the early evolution of ants. So the oldest crown ant fossils that we have are 99 million years old, and they co-occur in the same deposit as other stem ants. So we know that they were living in the same areas, and we don't know much more beyond that. So we have some estimates. So one of the things that I worked on during my PhD was a quantitative method to estimate the ecology of these extinct species based off of ecomorphological correlates from modern species. And so we have a sense of what the stem ants might have been doing and what the crown ants might have been doing. But it's very, very difficult to say, you know, what might have been sort of the level of competition between them. And when you're looking at fossil deposits from the mid-Cretaceous, the stem ants are much more common They are much more abundant. They are much more diverse in these deposits. But as we start going towards the end of the Cretaceous, we start seeing more crown ants emerging. And then after the K-PG extinction, after the end of the Cretaceous, all stem ants disappear. So they vanish somewhere in there, but because of the lack of fossil deposits right around the end of the Cretaceous, we don't know that much about what stem and crown ants might have been doing towards the very end there, and we don't have any fossil evidence of direct interactions between stem and crown ants. So it's very difficult to say.
How different were stem ants morphologically? What shapes they were, ecologically, how they were living. Were they still just, for all intents and purposes, being anty? Or was it like, you know, when you look back in the fossil record and you'll see one that's like 10 centimeters and got a six pack and tattoos and was just like completely wild, covered in spikes and looking really aggressive or...
Yeah, well, we do have the equivalent of the ant with the six-pack and the tattoos, and these guys were called hell ants. So these were ants that lived pretty much, we now know, all over the world for most of the mid-Cretaceous. So the oldest ant is a hell ant now from Brazil, that one that was just described. There are hell ants from Asia, hell ants from Europe, and hell ants from Canada. So they were all over the place. And from basically from the neck down, so their thorax and their abdomen looked pretty similar to what you would see on an ant today, but their heads were absolutely crazy. So all modern insects, except for one exception in the beetles, have mandibles that articulate in a horizontal plane. So they open up and they close horizontally. And these ants had mandibles that articulate in the vertical plane. So they had mandibles that articulate like ours, like our jaw opens and closes in the vertical plane. And they had these long spike-like mandibles that looked like basically mammoth tusks that opened and closed in the vertical plane. And often they had these horns that emerged out from like what kind of you can think of as their foreheads. And the mandibles articulated with the horns to spike prey right up against the horn. And that was probably what they did to kill the prey. And so these ants were just, they were crazy. We have no analog for them in modern ants. We have no analog for them in modern insects. They were just extraordinary. They're so much fun to look at. They're so much fun to work with. And so we did also have some stem ants that kind of look like, if you saw it walking around today, it would just look like an ant. You wouldn't know that that was a different ant. But these hell ants, you would know that that's a different ant. That's a weird ant.
I'm thinking of, you know, staple removers.
Yes, a little bit, actually. Yes, they kind of looked like that.
But it's incredible that, you know, you've got your mandibles, they're moving up and down, and evolves a spike on its head to act as like the opposing force on the other side of the jaw. Mm-hmm. Like it just grows a horn out of its head.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. And, you know, we were talking a little bit about bioaccumulation of metals. So micro CT scans of some of these ants find that there's actually part of that horn often had like sort of like a large paddle structure at the very tip. And that was where they would stab the prey into. And the paddle would sort of act as like, you know, maybe it was sort of like a suction almost in order to keep the prey there, or just because it was broader, it was more stable. But right in the center where the mandibles impacted is bioaccumulated metal. So they actually reinforce these horns for this snapping of prey right into their foreheads.
Wow.
Yeah, they were crazy. Yeah. So cool.
Absolutely metal. Like, it's so cool. It's so brutal. It sounds like such a really specific way to kill things as well. You just got to impale it.
Yeah, like, yeah. It's
not
it's
just bite it or sting it or anything normal. We're just going to impale them on our foreheads.
Mm-hmm. Well, the type species for the particular genus that I'm talking about, this one who has the bioaccumulated metal and the large paddle. The genus name is Lingua Myrmex, but the species name is Vladi, and you can kind of guess where that one came from.
Yeah, I can see where they get the name from as well.
Yeah.
And we should all tell our dads to be thankful that these aren't around.
I mean, they were tiny. They would have been very adorably trying to stab your finger and would not have been able to do anything about it. But if you were, you know, the size of like a little springtail or baby cockroach or something like that, these guys would have been the velociraptors.
Wow. So, all right, I was going to ask if there were any like lost ecologies in an evolution. And I guess like impaling things with your mandibles and foreheads are that kind of like lost ecology, like, well, a lost way of predation. But are there any different ways of living in all of the evolution of ants and stem ants that is now gone?
It's a really good question, and we don't really know for sure. My suspicion is because ants today are so incredibly diverse, you know, there might have been some sort of lost ecology.
Mm.
And it would have had to have been like incredibly specific for it to not be around anymore. You know, there are ants that are so specialized in what they do. So, for example, there are ants, you know, that farm a specific species of true bug. So they look a little bit like aphids, and they farm that one specific species of them for food. So, you know, the sheer ecological diversity of ants today makes it, I think, unlikely that there would be an extinct broad ecology of ants. But it's certainly a possibility. You know, you never know for sure, especially when you're looking back 100 million years.
So yeah, if I think a way of thinking about it is if you look at the diversity and the different ways of living of modern ants, ask yourself, like, what is missing in there? What other possible ways could ants possibly have ever lived? You've got them living on the bark, you've got them farming fungus and farming aphids and stuff. There's what else it could there be that they don't already do? Like the possibilities are almost endless. Like,
yeah, it's hard to imagine. I mean, the other thing too though is that before the discovery of hell ants, we would never have imagined that there were ants with vertically articulated mandibles that smashed prey into their zinc accumulated horns. And so, you know, the fossil record contains more than you could ever possibly imagine. And maybe we're just not imagining weird enough.
Mm. Oh, it's so exciting what could be there.
It's the opportunities are just endless when it comes to ants. And like, you know, this new discovery of a fossil ant in the Crato Formation in Brazil is so exciting because it changes so much more everything our understanding of like early ant evolution. And, you know, the fossil record just keeps on giving you surprises and you're like, I don't even know what to do with all of this.
So my next question, I'm kind of embarrassed by it now. I'd written, could ants be considered stabilomorphs? And that's kind of like the preferred term to a living fossil. Like, because I was going along the lines of they're all kind of just, you know, like anty and doing ant things and always been sort of eusocial. But no, it sounds like they're doing a lot of different things now.
I think when it comes to like the idea of ants as a stabilomorph, the answer really is yes and no. So there are ants from, so for example, there's an ant, one of the oldest crown ants known, that's fossilized in 92 million year old amber from New Jersey. And if you look at this ant, like even if you're somewhat of an expert in ants, you would look at this ant and you're like, you just took an ant from the sidewalk and you stuck it in resin. It looks exactly the same. So for a lot of lineages of ants, like they converged upon this body plan 100 million years ago, and they're like, okay, this is it. This works. And they changed absolutely nothing about it. And then when it comes to other lineages of ants, they changed so much. So, I mean, you can think of ants as stabilomorphs, but you can also think of them as crazy morphological experimenters. And it really depends on, like, what lineage you're looking at.
So what was happening during the Cretaceous that allowed for the evolution of ants? Is there anything happening in the Cretaceous? Or is it just, you know, they just happen to evolve there? Does it coincide, you know, like with a big climatic thing? Did they first appear in, say, like South America when some climatic upheaval was going on or something? Can we attach their evolution to any like global or regional events?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we honestly don't know for sure. But so ants evolved eusociality in the Cretaceous, bees evolved eusociality in the Cretaceous, wasps evolved eusociality in the Cretaceous. So clearly, you know, there was something going on in the Cretaceous that sort of predisposed a lot of these lineages, or conditions that meant that eusociality was more of a viable option for a lot of these lineages. And I think to some extent, it's probably related to the angiosperm terrestrial revolution. So the Cretaceous was a time of big ecological upheaval. So you start seeing, especially towards the end of the Cretaceous, the not necessarily the evolution of angiosperms, because they had evolved before then, but angiosperms beginning to become more dominant in these Cretaceous forests. And so this changes the structure of forests, and it also changes the structure of, it's going to sound super weird, but like the base of forests. So the leaf litter that these forests were depositing, the recycling, the detritus in these forests. And so it seems plausible that with all of this ecosystem restructuring, it probably afforded ants and bees and wasps this sort of opportunity to experiment, I guess, in a way. That so for ants, the earliest ants were probably predators. And with the evolution of and the restructuring of these new ecosystems, you would have been getting a lot of new diversification of such as like beetle or cockroach or true bug species. And so providing a lot of different opportunities for predatory species. With the evolution of angiosperms, also a different structure for herbivores. So as new herbivore species evolved, this would have restructured communities as well. So just everything going on with the angiosperm terrestrial revolution was probably providing opportunities for ants to evolve and to diversify.
Wow, that's, it makes sense thinking about it now. I don't know why I didn't think about that at all. And it's one of those things that it takes someone else to point it out and you're just like, ah, yes, of course.
Well, there's been so much more research lately too, like on the Cretaceous angiosperm terrestrial revolution, but like specifically on like insects in that time period. And the more that you look at like the crazy diversification and like really high rates of faunal turnover during this time, the more that you're like, okay, so this was just, you know, a time where insects, they were throwing everything at the wall to see like what stuck, and eusociality stuck.
How hard is it to get fossils in this time? Like you've spoken about the Crato formation, and I think that is a limestone. You've also spoken about ants in amber. Like, do they need these Lagerstätte, like sites of special preservation of fossils to be able to be preserved? Because you're not going to find like a fossilized ant nest or forest floor with like a load of like a little hole and then it's filled with ant fossils.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most of our understanding of ants comes from these Lagerstätten. And when it comes to amber, of course, like it's kind of you know, the gold standard, because they're preserved in 3D and they're usually preserved like beautifully well. So you get like these levels of preservation, sometimes like preservation of internal tissue and internal structures. But there are lots of really good compression fossils as well. And so compression fossils, basically, you usually need just something that's very fine grained. The sediments need to be very fine grained because ants are so small, obviously. If the sediment is coarse grained, you're just going to basically obscure, obstruct, destroy most of the ants that are being preserved. Usually ants are best preserved in, so for example, what you often get is preservations of these nuptial flights. So when a lot of males and queens are flying around and trying to mate with one another, and like they fall into water, and then they're basically preserved in these lake sediments as these mass death assemblages during a reproductive event. So that's one way that you get a lot of information about ants. Others are these amber deposits, usually in kind of coal deposits, where you tend to get a lot of amber from these forests. And so a lot of our understanding of the early ants tends to come from these big amber deposits. So we get a lot of great information, but it's also like somewhat biased because you're just getting it from this one amazing forest deposit.
Yeah. And that's a problem with paleontology in general, sample bias. So your arboreal ants, ones running around trees, they're the ones that are going to get stuck in amber. Your flying ones are the ones that are going to end up falling into a stinky lake and getting preserved there. Your rugged and mountain climbing ants, zero chance of them being preserved effectively. So do we have a really lopsided view of ant evolution based on this sample bias?
I mean, we definitely have a lopsided view of evolution based off of sample bias, but a fascinating thing about it is that we do tend to assume that amber is only going to preserve like arboreal communities because they're associated, you know, with the trees that are preserving the resin. But what's really fascinating is that really recent deposits, so deposits from the last like few hundred thousand years, and experiments. So people have put sticky traps on trees to simulate resin. These experiments and these really recent deposits have shown us that we actually get a lot more ecological diversity than we would expect. It's not necessarily just these arboreal species that we're getting. We're definitely getting more of those, but it captures a much wider variety of ant ecology than we thought that it did. And partially, you know, that's you can kind of think too about, mostly you're thinking about when you think about resin, it's coming out of trees that are standing up. But think about, you know, trees that fall over. Resin is produced as a response to some sort of mechanical, physical, or chemical trauma. And so this is actually occurring, you know, like if a tree, it gets like knocked down by a sauropod or something walking through, you're producing a lot of this resin and you're producing it really close to the ground and you're getting a lot of ground insects that are getting trapped in it. So it really, the arboreal bias is real, but it's not as much as we used to think.
I'm remembering, wasn't there something marine that ended up in some resin? Was it an ammonite?
Yes, an ammonite.
Was that real or was that a...
That was real, yeah.
It wasn't an April Fool's thing. That stood the test of time. I can't remember it, but... Yeah.
Yes. I was at the conference when they revealed that, and there was just a sort of like, all through the room. It was very exciting.
No, I'm like, fake!
Yes. I mean, it was a very acrimonious conference in spots, but nobody was yelling fake at that point.
Right. Time to kill everything. So how did they fare, the different groups, over the end Cretaceous mass extinction? A big asteroid, meteorite, bolide, smashes into Yucatan Peninsula. It's probably not a good time to be an ant. Right? You get buried? Or is it do they have like characteristics that would mean that they're more likely to survive. You know, you're buried underground, you can just live off scraps of food that you go forage.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the effect of the Cretaceous extinction on insects is very much kind of still up in the air, but a lot of insects actually made it through the Cretaceous extinction pretty well. And I think to some extent, yes, it was that there's such a diversity of different ant ecologies that if, you know, you're associated with trees, it might be a real bad day for you. But if you're a subterranean ant who's omnivorous and mostly sort of eating like dead insects and detritus, it's not the end of the world for sure. So when it comes to the Cretaceous extinction event, with crown ants at least, we don't have enough information really to know exactly what was occurring with the crown ants at that time. But with the stem ants, we do know that they disappear after that extinction event, but we also know that their diversity was declining before the extinction event as well. Mm. So the mass extinction event might not have actually had anything to do with their demise at all.
So it could be possible that they went extinct before it. How close up to the boundary do they go?
Yeah, so they go to about 75 million years ago. And so this is partially because we don't have a lot of deposits from the very latest Cretaceous. We don't have a lot of insect-bearing fossil deposits. But we do have one from 71 million years ago in Myanmar, and one from 67 million years ago in Canada. And there are no stem ants in those deposits. There's crown ants, but there's no stem ants. And considering the fact that, like, throughout most of the Cretaceous, you're seeing the opposite. You're seeing stem ants and few, if any, crown ants, it seems suggestive that they were either gone or they were really on the decline at that point.
Are people looking for them? Have a good relation? I know that ant people are looking for them. Are the dinosaur people looking for them? Like, because yes. I'm imagining they're in the Indiana Jones outfit. They're all about getting this bone out, and they're going to be on National Geographic. And there's this tiny little ant sitting on top of the bone, fossil ant, and they're just like, out the way, you. No one cares. It's just an ant. Who cares? Because we're here for just this dinosaur bone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say that, like, if you're doing vertebrate paleontology in a lot of these deposits, obviously, you're not necessarily, you don't really have that search pattern in your mind looking for fossil insects. But, I mean, so there are some deposits from the late Cretaceous in Canada where they're starting to find some amber and have been looking at it a little bit. But, again, it's also, there's so few people out there who are paleoentomologists and who are looking for this. And so, you know, like, sometimes we get these fossil insects from these deposits, but a lot of the time, they're not looking for it. They're not collecting the amber. They're not necessarily looking for the fossil insects. And so maybe they're occurring there and we're just missing it for sure.
I think I've done them a disservice. I think they would collect little things if they saw them.
I think they would too. I think maybe they just not.
I think it's a reflection of my opinion of dinosaur researchers and the gung-ho, let's get this toe bone out and name a new species after it, after some celebrity. But everyone, please keep in mind the little things are also mega important. You already know this, but it'd be so cool if, you know, like, some dinosaur researcher was just like, we've been going through all this sediment, here are some weird bug things that could be important.
Mm-hmm. Come on, dinosaur people, get us the fossil insects.
So let's compare before and after the extinction event with the modern crown ants Did they end up being tiny? Did they go massive? Was there any change at all? Did they just continue doing what they were doing?
For the most part, they continued doing what they were doing, in the sense that, like, you know, we do get some different weird looking ones, but nothing quite to the same extent as the stem ants, with one exception. And that is these massive, massive ants, where the queens were actually like the size of a hummingbird. And these guys lived kind of right around like that Paleocene, Eocene thermal maximum, where you did see a little bit of gigantism in other insect species as well. And so they did not last till present day. We don't have these guys around anymore. So there was not quite as much like morphological experimentation, but they did still get weird in some ways.
A hummingbird, I have no idea. I've seen them. I don't know how big they are. I'm guessing centimeters.
Yeah, 4 to 6 centimeters, I would say.
That's huge for an ant, though.
No, they were big. They were big.
Wow. Anyway, so I'm just... It doesn't make for good audio, but I'm just sat there looking at my fingers 4 to 6 centimeters apart and just going, wow, that is a big ant.
Then so. they were chubby too, like they were quite round. So it would have just been like looking at like some sort of massive like bee flying at you, like humming like a Harley Davidson. They would have been incredible to see.
And generally, how did they fare through the Cenozoic to the present day? Was like the Paleocene, Eocene thermal maximum, it's like a hot point in the Cenozoic. And so we get bigger ants there. Did we get a huge chunk of species at one particular time? Did they narrowly avoid extinction at another time? Or are they just kind of going at it, ants diverse and not a lot going on?
Yeah, I mean, so they did steadily increase in diversity throughout the Cenozoic. The Cenozoic was definitely a good time for ants. So when you look at the proportions of ants that you get in amber fossil deposits, so in the Cretaceous, there's like no more than one ant in every about 100 pieces of fossil amber that you get. And that's amber that includes a fossil insect specimen in it. So one in every 100 is an ant. But then as you start going through the Cenozoic, you start to see ants making up a much bigger proportion of all insect assemblages. And so, for example, once you get to 16 million years ago in the Dominican Republic fossil amber deposit, which is a famous amber deposit that produces really, really beautiful kind of like gemstone-like amber, they are so common that one in every, I think, 30 to 40% of fossil insect inclusions is not only an ant, but this one species of an ant, that they were so incredibly abundant and diverse there that like that was just what got fossilized. So the Cenozoic was a really good time for ants. It was a really good time to be an ant. I mean, today is also a really good time to be an ant, but it's been a trend that's been continuing.
Okay, so we're back in the present day. Ants are doing brilliantly. What questions about the evolution of ants, early evolution of ants, anywhere in the timeline, which questions have yet to be answered?
Oh, man, still so many. I mean, I spent my entire PhD on trying to figure out what happened to the stem ants, and I can tell you almost nothing about that. So, you know, that is definitely a big question. You know, what happened to the stem ants? Why did this very successful group, especially the hell ants, these successful groups go extinct? What happened to crown ants across the extinction boundary? We know that they were present, that they were perhaps not super diverse, not super abundant, but they managed to make it through the Cretaceous extinction event. The discovery of this new ant in the Cradle Formation resets a whole bunch of our hypotheses and our understanding of early ant biogeography and early ant evolution. Because the earliest ant now is a helminth, and that's a very specialized morphology. So, you know, they had to have had some time to get to that morphology. So what were they doing there at the very beginning? What are these factors that led to eusociality? We have ideas about this, but, you know, we still don't know exactly what led to the rise of eusociality in early ants. And there's still so much to know even about the evolution of ants during the Cenozoic. So how were these ants evolving during the Cenozoic as, you know, temperatures changed during the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum? How did they respond to that? How did cooling during the Oligocene, how did they respond to that? We still have, you know, an extraordinary fossil record of these ants and so very little known about them that I think, you know, we could have 100 people studying this for their entire careers and you would not run out of material to study.
And that's a lovely segue into my final question of saying that if anyone is wanting to study, like if you want to be one of these 100 of people trying to study ants, still not getting to the to answering everything, how do you start studying the evolution of ants? Why study the evolution of ants as opposed to anything more exciting like dinosaurs?
Well, I mean, one of the selling points I would say for ants instead of dinosaurs is that nobody is doing it. So you're not going to be competing with anybody. Mm. And if you're doing dinosaurs, you're going to be competing with a lot of people for very few specimens. That's another thing. If you're interested in ants, we got lots of ants. There are fewer dinosaurs out there. And if you want to look at the whole specimen of an ant, you can look at the whole specimen of an ant, but it's very hard to look at the whole specimen of a dinosaur. So definitely study ants instead of dinosaurs. But I would also say that like ants are such, they're fascinating on their own, but they're also such an incredible model for answering so many different questions that you might have more broadly about like paleoecology or paleobiogeography or patterns of evolution or the evolution of social behavior, because they are so diverse. So pretty much anything that you want to know about, you know, say how arboreal insects function, there's tons of ants for you to study for the evolution of arboreality in insects, the evolution of herbivory in insects, the evolution of specialized predation in insects. Ants, you know, they do it all. And so there's lots of different things to do there. But I would also say, like, if you want to study ants, go outside, see if you can like flip a rock over, break a twig open, and just watch them do their thing for a little while, because there's so much fun to watch as they interact with one another, as they interact with, you know, their babies, as they interact with the world around them. And just watching them will bring so many different questions to the forefront of your mind. And then you have 14,000 species to pick from, just from the extant stuff, and 100 million years of evolution to study. And it's just all wide open. So many questions right there for you.
That's awesome. It's an open goal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming on the show and explaining all of that. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. This was really delightful. It was a lot of fun to chat with you about this.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Liz Martin-Silverstone, Tom Fletcher, Nick Lupshire, Emily Keeble, and Sophie Pollard. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. But the show now relies on funding from you, our listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where you'll gain access to additional multimedia content. And thanks to everyone who's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.